welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Sundays at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m., Monday mornings at 1 a.m., streaming live at richarddugan.com, as well as SoundCloud and iTunes. And you can go to the radio show's page also to listen to the interviews that they are posted there as well. So we encourage you to do that. We're also linked to our guest's website on the radio show's page. So that's where you need to go to click on that link to go to our website, to the guest's website. Today is going to be a program that is designed for all of us, and it's certainly right up my alley as far as the subject matter, because I have been harping on this. I have been the strongest proponent of people getting educated. But then you raise the question, what kind of education and what are they teaching and what do you want to learn and so forth? And there are as many different directions that you can go in education as you can shake a stick at. However, what we're finding is that people aren't being taught how to think. They don't know how to process the information that they're being bombarded by on their phones and tablets and television and newspapers and radio and just about everywhere. And then, of course, do you trust it? I mean, there used to be back in the 90s when the internet first popped up. You can't believe anything you see on the internet because it's all fake and this and that and the other. But we have a special guest on the program who's going to talk to us about some no-nonsense. It's a no-nonsense critique. Yes, I can speak too. That's another thing. We'll go to linguistic school. No-nonsense critique that takes aim at 25 ideas in education that just don't work. And we're going to talk with him right now. Welcome to our program. David Slater, thank you so much for joining us on the broadcast.
Thanks for having me, Richard. I appreciate it.
You're a teacher.
I am.
And you're still teaching. What grades?
I'm
what
in
level,
my 20th
I
year. I teach 7th and 8th graders in a middle school in Reno, Nevada.
And you've been doing it for, as you say, 20 years. And I'm sure you have seen, you've seen the system change over those 20 years, and not necessarily for the better. I've often joked with our listeners and other guests that I've often wanted to go and sue my grade school and high school for malpractice, because there are things I'm learning now that it seemed so simple now, so innocuous. Why the heck wasn't I taught this? Why didn't I know that, for example, when I sent my book off to my sister, who is a proofreader, that the word "and" in a list of things is as grammatically correct as using commas, except for the last two items where you would use the word "and"? I didn't know. I should have learned that in English, that there are many different ways to punctuate, among other things. Or, for example, Pearl Harbor. I was taught that the Japanese never made it to the mainland U.S. I moved to Santa Barbara. That's all I hear about all of the different infiltrations by the Japanese to U.S. mainland. It didn't last, but they got here. Those are just two examples. And then, of course, there was this form of math, whole math, I remember reading about a few years ago, that was basically 2 + 2 = 4. That's what you would teach your eighth graders, right? Ah, but whole math is 2 + 2. Let's discuss it. Okay. Yeah. So there are 25. Let's go. Maybe we should just kind of go down that list of 25
sure.
items, because it's Memory Road is one of them, and so forth and so on. But why don't you go down this list and share with us that particular perspective from where you come from as a teacher?
Sure. Well, it's funny you talking about changing over time. In my actually 23 years, honestly, the biggest difference is how much time I have to waste dealing with standardized tests, which now takes, I'm going to say, 5, sometimes 6 weeks out of the year, even longer. But yeah, that's just one of many issues, standardized testing. Let me start by saying, okay, so the book's called We're Doing It Wrong, and I'm arguing that bad ideas come to our classrooms. And I'll start off by just sharing the 4 reasons why I think that happens. And then if you want, I can just pull out any of the 25 topics.
Sure.
So first of all, I argue, or I point out, that right now very few people in the United States who have actual power over public education have any actual training in education. crazy it sounds, right?
Yeah.
If you just jump on any school board, any random school board list of resumes, you're not likely to see a single one with a degree in education or even practical experience in a classroom. So it sort of boggles my mind that I've noticed that like education is the only career or the only field that virtually everybody feels like they're an expert in. And so it seems like we don't care if even the people who are running it have no training in it. So for that reason, bad ideas make to the classroom. The second thing I argue is that politics force teachers to basically ignore reality. So we have to pretend things are true that just simply aren't true. The biggest example I could share is that teachers have to pretend that they can educate every single child to the very highest standards, say college readiness, no matter what challenges they face. And everybody who actually teaches knows that's just not true. And that is not to suggest that teachers ever give up on trying to accomplish that for every child. But it seems to me that like facing reality would be a better way to begin a conversation about teaching.
Let me dive off on that one real quick.
Sure.
I made a comment to a local college professor. We were having a wonderful conversation and we got off onto the subject of education. And I said, well, I believe that everybody deserves an education, you know, free or otherwise. And this was a college professor who said this to me. He said, no. Not everybody deserves an education because, and this was his verbatim, word for word, some people are stupid. And I thought, wait a minute, well, what's the, you know, we never got any further than that because he had to go. I thought, well, what the heck is the definition of stupid and who gets to make that determination? Now, everybody learns differently, which I know you would agree with. And not everybody has the aptitude, if you will, or the capacity necessarily to trudge through 4 years of university, what have you, maybe vocational school, maybe on the job training and so forth. But it just seems to me that everybody does deserve an education. Am I wrong? Am I living in a fairy tale world?
No, I mean, that's a really disturbing thing to have heard an educator say. I'm hoping he didn't really mean deserve. Everyone deserves the opportunity to get as far as they can in their education.
Yeah.
To give the guy the benefit of the doubt, I mean, maybe he's just talking about actually what you say, which is that we force kids who actually want to, say, pursue a vocational track. We have basically decided that every kid has to want to get to college. And so we don't teach shop class. We don't provide other avenues. Maybe that's what he meant, because I would argue we need to have all of these roads open to everybody. And of course, they all deserve what they need to get down the road that they want to travel. Yeah. But teachers having to get back to the original point, it's really difficult as an educator when you're held responsible for solving, you know, for getting every kid to college who has tremendous, you know, challenges. Or the second example I would put under this topic is teachers have to pretend that it doesn't matter. Well, two things. It doesn't matter how many kids are in their classroom, which is another subject. And it doesn't matter what range of skills. So when I was teaching, I used to teach in Oregon in a regular education, seventh and eighth grade classroom. And I would have 35 kids. I would have some kids who literally couldn't read past the third grade level and kids who could read a college dissertation and pretty much the whole range in between. And it's, I call it radical inclusion. What the current term, proper term is called differentiation. Teachers are supposed to be able to basically tailor their curriculum and their teaching to different learning levels. And within reason, that's a great idea, but we're well beyond reason. And we have these gigantic classes with such a huge spread that teachers can't handle, but politics forces us to pretend that we can't. So that's the second reason.
Mm-hmm.
Another question in there?
Yeah, well, I was just going to toss out, there's a sort of cute little song that I heard back in the late 70s, early 80s. And the basic premise of the song is that this kid goes to his first day of school and they pull out crayons and they start to draw. And the kid's just drawing flowers in all kinds of colors all across the rainbow.
Yeah, I know this song.
You know, Harry Chapin song. Exactly.
Harry Chapin, yeah.
And then, of course, you know, the teachers are, no, flowers are red and green leaves are green. There's no need to see flowers any other way than the way they've always been seen. And you'll draw them the way we tell you to, or you're going to sit in the corner and you're going to sit there until you get it. And this actually ties into also the whole religious search. I found this out when I was working for a Christian station in the 80s, early 90s, where they said there was only one way to God, and yet we have so many different variations of foods that we can eat and things we can drink, educational pursuits, job, career, relationships, places we can live, things we can live in, et cetera, all kinds of styles of clothes, and there's only one way to God? And yet we're sort of saying the same thing about education, that there's only one way to do it. But we can't even decide on that.
Yeah. You're hitting the nail on the head for my third reason mm-hmm. why so many bad ideas come. And it's not really just about – I think the smaller problem is teachers forcing kids to learn in one way. In fact, so my third reason is that we've come for some reason in America to think – or we've decided that teaching is wholly and only a science. When in fact, I would argue, of course, it's a science, but it is more an art. Mm. And we don't, and because we have decided it's a science, we have, you know, this standardized test craze, but we basically have come to view teachers as factory workers who we think could and should produce the results we want if they would just follow the directions. So associated with this is this huge pressure to conform. Teachers are supposed to teach only what's considered best practice, quote unquote. So they have to have the same styles. They have to use the same materials. Worse, I don't know if you're aware of this trend, but there are districts around that are forcing teachers to teach, quote unquote, by reading a script to their kids, literally word for word, not allowed to deviate by a single word. I mentioned in my book that there's a case that made the papers where a teacher that was applying for a job at a charter school in Rochester, his interview was to read the script and show that he could read it well. So it's awful. And teachers, I've never met a single teacher who got in this field to be an automaton whose primary responsibility is to train kids to pass corporate tests. So teachers do not, this is why we have, and we can talk about this teacher crisis that's arising everywhere. And that's one of the primary reasons. All the creativity is being drained out of the job, usually all in the name of achievement scores on standardized tests.
Hmm. Well, I have to say, it's just absolutely astounding that this kind of stuff continues. It literally continues to go on, and we don't challenge it. I have to say that. Regardless of regardless of my personal political or likes or dislikes, when I heard the very first reports about UCLA or Berkeley, they invited this fella come in. He was a conservative to talk, and I thought, well, that's great, you know, because you're getting different ideas. At least, you know, you have a chance. And the place blew up, and I'm thinking, well, wait a minute, hold the phone here. I thought that higher learning had to do with at least not necessarily agreeing with, but at least listening to other views. Now, I don't know about you, but I go back in my early days in broadcasting in the early 80s when Ronald Reagan deregulated the FCC. And one of the mm-hmm. things that he did that I thought, and I still think to this day, was a travesty. And I have nothing against the man himself. But I thought this was a mistake when he deregulated the FCC and eliminated the fairness doctrine.
The fairness doctrine. Yeah, I knew that was coming.
Not many. And I was actually talking with a conservative on one of these programs, and it was off the air here in Santa Barbara in 2018. And I shared with him this, and I said, you know, don't you think that we should be talking about both sides of an issue? And he agreed. You know, we were talking. I says, then you would be in favor of bringing back the fairness doctrine, wouldn't you? And he looked at me. And he seemed to know what that was, and so I explained it to him, and he said, well, yeah. Now, I got a comment from a libertarian who said, oh, no, we don't want the government telling us what to do. And I thought, well, wait a minute. The government's already telling you what to do. When you go out in your car and you get out on the road, they're telling you that you have to stay within these lines and you have to stop at the stop signs and the red lights. And then you go at the green lights. The government's telling you what to do.
Yeah, of course. I couldn't agree with you more about the fairness doctrine.
Yeah,
I think it's a travesty. And I think furthermore, I think I'm correct that back in the day, the networks were required to donate their time for their national news.
Yeah.
And so there wasn't the pressure
and public
affairs, the corporate pressure.
Yeah.
Right. So you don't have to sensationalize every news story because you're competing against the other ones. So I'm afraid that our whole culture of news is a disaster for that reason. Yeah. And we just get the most extreme views because, again, it's a competition for eyeballs.
Let me ask you about textbooks. Now, when I was growing up and going to school, I was already hearing the phrase dumbing down of our educational system.
Yeah.
And so I began processing that in my own mind. And here's the conclusion that I came to. If the system is being dumbed down, and the students that are being taught in the 70s, they go on to higher education and they've been dumbed down and the system continues to be dumbed down. So the next generation, and then you have the first generation there from the 70s that starts to write the textbooks, and then the next generation writes the next generation of textbooks, and on and on and on. And if the system, it's kind of like cloning. If you clone a clone and then you clone another, you clone that clone and you clone that clone, every time you get a worse copy of the original. It's similar to in broadcasting when you would make a copy of a tape and then you'd make a copy of that and a copy of that. Finally, you could barely understand what's being said on the audio tape because it's six or seven or eight or nine or 10 generations. It's useless. So what are your thoughts in that regard? Has the educational system been, as the phrase was used, dumbed down? And is there recovery? Is there a way to, I don't know, do we want to go back? Or what will it mean to go forward if the system indeed has been dumbed down?
I'm not so sure it's been dumbed down. I don't even teach with a textbook. A lot of teachers hate textbooks these days. And I think teaching styles and teaching methods, despite the conformity pressures I was talking about, have improved. I mean, there's such a greater understanding now of student needs and student difference. I would say rather than dumbing down that it's political pressures that make it appear that, I mean, our expectations are so much higher, like I mentioned at the beginning. We want every single student, no matter what, to succeed. And because of that, sometimes we work backwards. And they're forcing, how can we get our numbers, more graduates, more passing tests? Well, when the pressure is applied to the people who are expected to make that happen, what I notice is that they have to lower the bar. And they're coming up with all kinds of crazy ways. Recently, for example, there are some schools who have decided, I can give credit to their motives if you want, but their decisions are baffling. So, for example, there are schools who are instituting a policy where if a student who does not turn in an assignment, that student will not get a zero. That student will be given a 50% on their report card.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
So for doing nothing.
Wow.
And again, their motives are usually because they think that there's institutional racism and they're trying to get kids who generally, have a difficult road to get through their educational path. So motives, fine. Methods, crazy, in my opinion.
Yeah.
And so, as you could probably predict, kids figure that out really fast. So they do nothing for 3/4 of their quarter or their semester, or whatever. And then they know what minimum amount they can do to go from not from a zero to a passing grade, but from a 50. So this has nothing to do with textbooks or curriculum, but just politics.
Yeah.
I would argue, I'll talk about the two biggest changes that I think are necessary, one of which is doable, though it would be a pretty radical change. I would stop sending kids through their educational careers grouped by age. There's no reason for age-based education that I've ever seen that makes any logical sense or educational sense. It's just what we do because it's easier to manage.
Right.
But in my opinion, age-based education is the reason why we have so many kids bored to death in their classrooms. It's the reason we have so many kids sitting in classrooms for which they're totally unequipped and can't handle. I think it's the reason we don't know what to do with kids who don't learn what they're supposed to learn in a given year. So that would be my change that's actually possible. But the biggest problem that's so daunting, in my opinion, that sometimes I feel like, you know, I wrote a book of 25 suggestions, but sometimes it makes me feel like I'm really just suggesting moving deck chairs around on the Titanic. Because the real problem here is poverty. It's the egregious income inequality in this country. 50% of American public school students qualify for free and reduced lunch. 50, half of our kids. Wow. We allow to come to school suffering from all of the stresses related to poverty, stresses that make it difficult, sometimes impossible to learn. So I'm afraid, in my most, if you want to catch me on my pessimistic day, I'm afraid that until we decide that that's not acceptable as a country, we're really in for a hard road, no matter, you know, how many times, how many tests we invent, you know, how many times we tell teachers they're responsible for fixing this problem. I'm afraid we're in for a hard road.
Well, I do have to say that I have been incredibly fortunate in my not only career, but in my life, because of my career, that I have been exposed to a lot of people who have, I've met more people either A, going through their PhD program, or who already have it. And we sit and chat during the breaks and after the program is over, and the information that I glean from them is just, it's wonderful. I mean, I have to tell you, it's just incredible. I should have my PhD, but I couldn't focus on any one thing because I've been so exposed to so many different thoughts and ideas, whether it's religion or economics or education in this case, or whatever the, you know, throw up subject matter, food and wine and blah, blah, blah. And I've just been trying to soak it all in, and it's just incredible what's out there. But not everybody's being exposed to the same things, and so they don't have that same diverse, if you will, or eclectic, educational base. And I'm just a firm believer in giving people that opportunity.
I agree, and it's, I mean, you're using some of the key words that people bring up who understand the deficits that kids in poverty suffer with, and it's exposure is the key word. They come into kindergarten just drastically behind in terms of their language development, just simply because they're not exposed to it at home. So before they even step foot in our school or institution of public education, they are looking way up the hill. And, you know, studies show that it's incredibly difficult, if not impossible, that they'll ever make it up. And this, again, before kindergarten. So it's going to take far more. It's going to be an entire national effort to fix these opportunity gaps, or what they're called, so that kids can start school on an even playing field.
Are you optimistic that that's going to happen? Or maybe rephrase that. Are you optimistic that there is an environment that will allow or help to foster it to happen?
Yeah, my current pessimism actually is also sort of optimistic, because your listeners probably are aware that we're seeing strike after strike, teacher walkouts around the country. I think we're very soon going to hit a crisis so significant nationally. I mean, there are states all over the country, like Nevada, declaring emergencies because they can't fill their classroom jobs. So I'm going to go sidebar here real fast. Sure. So they're doing, you know, things like hiring unqualified teachers, or forcing teachers to teach out of their field, or trying to lure people out of the workforce. None of those solutions address the actual heart of the problem. So, you know, I think there are multiple reasons. The headline reason is always salaries, and salaries are unacceptable to teachers. It's well established that teachers make far less than peers with the same level of training, and every single year they stay in their career, that gap gets wider. There's stories everywhere now of teachers working 2-3 jobs after school to make ends meet. So I don't want to minimize that, but there are other reasons. Teachers feel attacked and disrespected and blamed for student choices that are beyond their control. But with both of those said, I think it's this deprofessionalization that I was talking about earlier that's slowly pushing teachers out of the field. So all that said, back to my point, which is we're going to reach a point where nationally we have such a crisis finding teachers that we're going to have to look in the mirror and we're going to have to ask ourselves why nobody wants this job anymore. And when we get to that point, they're going to finally listen to teachers. Back to my very first point here about how nobody who makes these decisions listens or has training in education. And then they're going to start hearing these, I would think, some of the kind of things that I'm saying. And from that point, maybe there's some hope.
Yeah. It does sound daunting, to say the very least. However, excuse me. However, it does seem to me that, you know, we need to do something. I can't help but pose this question when I look at and listen to the leader of the largest the country of the free world. And I wonder where in the hell did he get his education? Because he doesn't sound that educated. And yet, you know, the claims of success and all of these kinds of things. And I'm sorry, I just don't see it in the way that he presents himself. And it just seems to me like we're losing, in addition to our loss of civility. And again, I don't want to get into politics. But when you see people out there who some just in the way that they communicate is it sometimes just seems so primitive. Now, maybe that's just the way some folks are, and I shouldn't cast aspersions in any way, shape, or form. But then it's like, well, then what's the point of even having an education if you're not learning how to communicate in a civilized society?
Well, I agree. I mean, it's extremely distressing, especially because so many people to actually point to that kind of behavior as a quality they find attractive. Yeah.
I've shared with people that, and I've even shared this with my mother. I said that I did not care for this man, not because of his politics, but because he came across to me as a bully. I dealt with bullies in school when I was in grade school and high school. I didn't want one as the leader of the free world. And so, you know, it's like you can toss all the politics aside. He's a bully. That's my perception of him, okay? And that if I spoke to my mother the way he speaks to other people, I would have very red cheeks right now. Very red. My mother wouldn't put up with it. So I just wonder sometimes how we as a society are putting up with this level of incivility, if that's the right word.
It is the right word.
Very good. Thank you. I learned something.
I actually think that this conversation is really related to what we were talking about before, with the fairness doctrine. Mm-hmm. And what I would argue is that the corporate environment for news, I mean, what do they bring on? They bring on, the two most polarizing people who have an opinion on the subject at hand. Mm. And they want them to basically, you know, make fireworks. Yeah. So I think we have a generation that's raised on that model as an example of public discourse.
Yeah. Why don't you give them each a pistol?
Yeah.
You know, and whoever comes out alive is the winner of the argument. I mean,
well,
that's
I think you just invented a reality show news program.
Oh, Lord, please don't give me credit for that one. No. And it is kind of sad, too, because when I was a kid growing up, you know, in the 60s and 70s, you know, I still remember a situation where we were sitting at the dinner table, and I'm from a family of eight, six kids, and my brother and I and four Wow. sisters. My father sat at one end of the table, and my brother and I sat across from each other at that end of the table next to my dad. And then my four sisters were seated in the other seats, and my mother was at the other end of the table. And I remember one dinner we were sitting there eating, and my father asked my brother, he was probably, I don't know, maybe 13, 14, asked him, would you please go in the kitchen and get me the bowl of potatoes or whatever it was? To which my brother responded, I could not believe, I don't know where this came from. He says, who broke your legs? You talk to your father that way? I just wouldn't do it. Well, and so yeah, anyway.
I mean, I think that's a real phenomenon. I'm actually working on a follow-up book, which is basically about how all good ideas are dragged to ruin by their most ardent supporters. And I think you're putting your finger on one example, which is sort of the anti-authoritarianism, I guess you could maybe identify, starting in the 60s for very good reason. We've taken so far that there are no authority figures that are worthy of respect, including your own father. Obviously, this doesn't describe everyone, but I think it describes a pretty disturbing amount of people in our culture today.
Well, and as I said, it's a sad commentary on where we have where we've wound up here in the 21st century. I mean, I'm still waiting for the flying cars. I hear they're coming, but, you know, because I grew up with the Jetsons. So come on.
Yes.
Let's get with the program. Where are the engineers that were supposed to come out of the educational system that I was in? You know, where are they? You know, because, you know, when I shared with you about this, that concept that I remember reading about, and it was probably 15, 20 years ago, new whole math where you discussed the solution to a simple problem like 2 + 2. And my first thought when I read the article was, oh, you know what? We'd never have gotten to the moon if we had used that kind of math. Although there are those who say we never went to the moon, but that's another subject for another day.
That is another story. But, you know, I think that you're putting your finger on another example of what I just suggested, which is good ideas taken too far. So, in fact, I was just talking to – so I'm here in Toronto to do a TV interview for this book, and I was visiting a family, and I was talking to their teenage son who didn't read my book, but when he heard the title, he's like, I agree with you that we're doing it wrong. And I said, well, that's interesting. Well, like, what do you think is doing wrong? What we're doing wrong? And he mentioned that in his math class, since you bring it up, he said basically it doesn't matter whether you get the right or wrong answer. It's only the process. And he didn't really didn't have much nuance in his thought about that, but he knew something was wrong with it.
Yeah.
And what I mentioned to him is what I think we made a wise step forward when we decided, I don't know when, 10, 15 years ago, that getting the correct answer isn't the only important thing, and that students need to demonstrate their thinking. And that is why we now put a lot of emphasis on the process so the teacher can see how they got to that answer.
Yeah. I always talked about show your work.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And we've taken that so far, at least some teachers have, to suggest that the actual achievement at the end of the day is not important. When in fact, of course, both the process and the ultimate reason for the process are both very important.
Yeah. You know, it's fascinating to me because when I was working for the religious radio station, the Christian Evangelical station, I was questioning a lot of the programmers, so ministers and pastors. I would off air. I would not challenge them, but we'd have healthy debates, you know, healthy conversations about specific principles. And I used to tell them, I said, well, the reason that I'm even bringing this up is because the conclusions that many of you have come to, they don't make any sense to me. It doesn't register in my logical brain. And so I continued to ask questions, and I remember specifically that it took me from the time I started to think about it until I finally got over it. It took me 5 years to finally release myself from the concept of a literal devil and hell, because it doesn't make any sense. Plus the fact that you have this God who says it's either my way or the highway. Well, that's no choice. You know, what kind of a choice is that? You know, but again, if that's what people choose to believe, I'm not going to sit here and disparage that. It's just that's just my perspective and my observations. I'm not here to change the world from that standpoint. If that's what you choose to believe, then more power to you. And I hope that it continues to serve you the same as, you know, whatever educational process that you're in. We're doing it wrong. 25 ideas in education that just don't work. And we're going to come back and talk about how to fix them with my guest, David Slater, and we're here on Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I please ask you to stay right where you are.
Tell me your stories. I'll do my best to understand you
We're back here on Tell Me Your Story, and I have to tell you, David Michael Slater, who's the author of We're Doing It Wrong, you know what came up during the break for me, what flashed in my mind? That old Cheech and Chong bit. Class! I know you remember.
Good old Cheech and Chong.
Exactly. And I have to tell you that I actually had some classes that were like that. Usually it was with the substitute teacher, because I remember, especially in seventh grade, I had a teacher by the name of Mr. Benner. He was pretty strict, but he had also did have a compassionate and gentle side that he showed from time to time, which I was very pleased about. This whole process of education in the United States, is it this? And I don't know how you're in Canada today. I don't know how well traveled you are around the world. I'm just curious. Is it this bad in the rest of the world?
I'm definitely not an expert, but I have talked to some folks here in Canada. I've been visiting lots of old friends, and they've been asking me about the book. And when I've described, this whole obsession with conformity and supposed best practice that every teacher has to conform to, they said they found that baffling. They do have standardized tests here, but they don't feel that they're quite at the point where they've basically taken over all aspects of education or control it all. But they're worried about it. I mean, they were interested. All my friends said sort of Canada, they want to know what's going on as a warning, basically, in the United States, so they cannot end up down the same road.
So we are actually being good teachers by showing them where they don't want to go.
Negative exemplars, we call that in the classroom, yes.
Well, I have to say that phrase actually stuck in my mouth for the longest time until I was actually able to verbalize it about our president. Thank you, teacher, for showing me how I don't want to behave. That was the takeaway for me.
Yeah, I understand.
It's really interesting. The only other person I know of that I just saw recently on a news program, 60 Minutes, who is similar and is the predecessor to Donald Trump, is Ted Turner. He was even asked the question, would you ever think about going after the highest office in the land? Because he was having too much fun building CNN and doing all the other corporate stuff and just having a blast being who he was. But he was also outspoken, but he also, would kind of tongue-in-cheek it, but, he wouldn't be too kind to certain... I mean, I remember they played this one sound clip where he was not too kind to Italians, for example. We have these people in our country, and I'm sure they're elsewhere in the world. I wonder if Putin's like this, but I don't understand Russian, so I wouldn't know. What about that also in terms of languages? I met a foreign exchange student from Italy who learned five languages in Italian school, and I barely am able to make it through with English. Now, I have a little computer programming language understanding, okay? Audio production language. I can read a sound wave. But in terms of being able to communicate with other people of other languages, the closest I've come is Gaelic, where my wife and I actually took a Gaelic language speaking language course. How valuable is learning another language to us, just in terms of our brain's development?
I think it's incredibly valuable. I mean, Americans are sort of... In my limited world travels, Americans are sort of well-known and notorious for only knowing English. So I think it's incredibly valuable for the reasons you just say, and not to mention just the sort of perspective shift that I would argue happens when kids learn to think through another language and just to prioritize a whole culture and system that's not their own. I think there's infinite reasons for kids to learn other languages and to travel if it's possible.
Yeah. All right. So we're going to dive in here, and I mean we're going way into the deep end here. Okay.
All right. How got do my we PFD on?
Okay. How do we fix it? Where do we start?
Well, I would start with blowing up the age-based system. I honestly don't see that happening. But I think it's a really important conversation. I'd like to hear those who like the system as it is to justify it, because, as I mentioned, in all my career, I've never actually heard a pedagogically based reason or educationally sound reason that we do this with our kids. I think it would change things radically. Personally, I'll go even further for something that's not going to happen. But when I'm put in charge of the world, I would do education like maybe you remember swim lessons back in the day. When I had to take swimming lessons, which I hated, the instructor would stand. This was in a lake at a summer camp. The instructor would stand on the dock with a big card that had a bunch of skills on it. And when I demonstrated a skill to her satisfaction, she checked a box. And when they were all checked, I earned that badge. I would actually run schools – I'm oversimplifying here for the sake of conversation. But I would run schools on a badge-based system that had nothing to do with your age. And you would earn those badges in the exact same way by demonstrating the skills that whoever created the system would deem equal, a course level. In high school, it would be more complicated. There could be multiple badges that would make up a larger degree. And to return to an earlier point of our conversation, there would be badges that were related to vocational schools, and you could earn them. I would say that you could earn them by 16, the simplest ones, and you could leave school and go to work if that is what you wanted to do. Maybe there's more complicated vocational badges that would take you all the way through age 18, but all those options would be there. I also think that kids should be able to leave school at 16 because there are advanced kids who we hold back, who we just don't allow to accelerate their way through their education. They're bored and sometimes end up dropping out. And then there are kids who are absolutely sure that college is not for them. I would let them leave. And then there are kids who just cannot, because their lives are so difficult, they cannot learn during the time that we want them to learn. However, I have to throw in what I would combine with that, what I'd couple with that, is the kid that anybody should be able to return to public education at any time. So if our 15-year-old drops out and goes to work for whatever reason, and when they're 19, they're ready now, they should be able to come back and enter the school at the level where they need it. Hmm. So that's these are my radical solutions that are not likely to happen. But you asked, right?
Yeah, I did ask. I did. And they always tell you, be careful what you ask for, because you better be ready for the answer. Mm-hmm. Now, when I was in school in the 70s, I was taught that boys and girls, males and females, learn differently. Boys, they've got a lot more energy, and it's kind of hard for them to sit still in the seat and learn anything. And girls, they, their brains are probably developing a little faster than the boys are, and so forth. And so they're going to pick up on things a little quicker. And then I got out of school in 1978, graduated from high school, and I started hearing the stories about Ritalin and how they wanted to normalize our children. And I'm going, well, wait. But you just told me back there that children learn differently, males and females especially, as far as categories, let alone individuals. And now you're going to normalize them? How is that going to work? Are we still doing that in our schools these days? Are they still using drugs to... Because again, this is an observation. I'm not making a statement. Observation is that everything that's being labeled as ADD and all of those other alphabetical acronyms for hyperactivity and so forth, boys are just, they're just, that's the way they are when they're growing up, and girls sometimes too. And yet we're drugging them. What's going on today in the 21st century in that regard?
Well, I don't want to claim to be an expert in this, so I can just tell you about my brushes with it.
Yeah.
I'll start by saying I have seen kids who absolutely 100% needed medication, who could not function in any level of reasonable expectation without it. And on their medication, they were able to actually learn something. So I'll say that. I will also say at the same time that it does seem worrisome that we've pushed our high expectations so low into the young ages that I do worry that there are kids who are just being kids who are being medicated. But I can't really weigh in on like to have the to how widespread that problem is. It is something that worries me. But my main thought in listening to you talk about that, about boys and girls and learning differences, is I feel like we've come pretty far in understanding gender differences, and I think we know it would be a dramatic mistake to say if you're a boy, you're going to learn in the boy style, the active style in girls. But that said, there are many boys who would benefit from a more active learning style, but also some girls, like you say. So the bottom line here is what I advocate, much more. You asked me what I would fix, and I gave you my radical answers. But there are some good things being done in terms of options. I think that the real answer is to understand that, to go back to your point, that there are many roads that are leading where we want to go. And the more options we can provide for kids, the better. So I think that a parent with a boy who understands their boy or girl, who understands that kid would learn in an environment that's like hyper-competitive and gamified, they should be able to find a school like that or a classroom like that or a hallway like that. I think there should be single gender options for schools. Again, maybe it's a hall. High schools, there are a lot of districts that are sort of pursuing this idea in terms of they have specialized high schools. So you can sign up and apply to go to the culinary high school, or you can go to the arts and health science one, or arts and crafts one. So that is a trend that I think is positive and growing. And I can only hope that it eventually applies to all levels of education. Of course, it always comes down to money. I mean, like if I'm poor and I want to go to that school on the other side of the town, how do I get there? So that's a separate question. But that is really my answer that in terms of things that are happening now that can keep happening, is understand options and provide as many as possible. And stop pretending, like what I try to recommend, I say several times in my book, if anybody tells you there's a single answer that solves any real problem in education, they're either naive or they're trying to sell you something.
Now, back in the 60s, I think it was, and maybe even in the 70s, there were some teachers who took their students out of the classroom and took them out, onto the grounds, and they would teach under the trees. Mm-hmm. And, when I saw that kind of stuff going on, even on some of the TV programs, I thought, well, that looks pretty cool, Of course, then you also run the risk of lots of different distractions, depending upon, where your school is. If it's in an urban setting, you got the traffic and sirens and so on and so forth. And yet, there seems to be, especially when it comes to just our general, as adults, our general well-being to reconnect with nature, seems like that'd be a great place to teach, not only as a space to teach in, but also to teach from. In other words, using nature as whether your chalkboard or your beaker and test tubes, that kind of thing, in terms of teaching people and teaching the students in a quite practical way. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, there are teachers who do that, and there are school districts that have things called outdoor school where they'll take the kids for actual multiple days, even a week. So there's definitely an awareness of trying to connect that. But I would go further and say that there should be a school. There are kids that they're outdoor kids.
Yeah.
And there should be a school that's sort of like wouldn't be every day, all day. But I would love it if there was an option in every school district for outdoor kids where most of your day, every day, was outside. I think that would be wonderful. But there are kids who would absolutely hate that, and who would not want any part of it.
Well, I tell you, it's to me, I've said this on more than one occasion on this program, and it wasn't necessarily dealing directly with our educational institutions. Just in terms of the way in which we conduct ourselves, whether it's in business or on the job or our economic systems and so forth, we need to learn from nature. And speaking of economics, I often say, show me what species other than man stores away supplies for more than one season. There isn't one. There isn't one. So it's just truly fascinating to me. The other thing too, maybe diving into the issue of history, there's so much that I I didn't learn, or I either that or I just missed it when it was being taught, which is entirely possible, about what was going on in other parts of the world. But by the same token, we're learning as time goes on and new discoveries are made. Like, for example, when we were celebrating the 500th anniversary of Christopher Columbus back in the 90s, I got three different stories of Christopher Columbus. One was he was an angel. The other was he was a devil. And the other was somewhere in the middle. And I thought, okay, between the three of these is the truth. And I'm going to have to make that determination. And of course, then there are people who disseminate information because they have an agenda. They want to promote a particular thing rather than giving you the raw information. But the problem with that is, and you probably have something to say on this, is that we don't know how to process it. We don't know what to do with it once we get it.
Well, that's what the focus should be on. I mean, there's universes of information like available to even a child at the touch of their finger.
Yeah.
So,
what are your thoughts about the internet as far as gathering information? I know that there are bad sources, but how do you find the good sources? What are your thoughts on that? I know there's this place called the Khan Academy. For people, they can learn all kinds of stuff on this place and so forth. But what are your thoughts in terms of the internet and information?
Yeah, Khan Academy is for tutoring, and it's a lot of students use that. Well, let me say this. In the English language arts program, we've devised a three-year program that we call media literacy. And I'm amazed that this is not taught everywhere all the time. The sixth graders learn propaganda techniques that are used in advertising. And they're able very quickly to easily look at an ad and say, oh, that's bandwagoning. You know, they're telling everybody to join the crowd. The seventh graders learn merchandising techniques. So they walk into a store or any sort of physical sales environment, and they understand and can identify like a whole host of persuasion techniques. And the eighth graders sort of look at media and culture. So it's actually life-changing. The kids, when they come out of it, say that they don't shop the same way. They don't think the same way when they're exposed to advertisements. Part of also is this part of, we weave into there now, you know, how to assess whether information is valid or not, the whole fake news phenomenon. It's the most ideal curriculum for middle schoolers who kind of already feel the world is set up to rip them off.
Yeah.
And we should be doing that everywhere.
Yeah.
Again, it's just giving them skills to interpret and skills to research. But it's media literacy is a kind of a movement around the world. Actually, Canada is the kind of on the forefront of it. But it should be required, in my opinion,
yeah.
And starting in elementary school, actually.
You know, this phrase that obviously came up 2.5-3 years ago, fake news. To me, nowadays, when people use that phrase, it's whatever you disagree with is fake news.
Yeah, absolutely.
Doesn't make it fake, doesn't make it untrue. It's just you disagree with it. So why don't you just say, I disagree, you know?
Well, they're getting that from their political role models.
Exactly. What about religious education? And I don't necessarily mean teaching them about God and so forth, but what about learning about the other philosophies on the planet? Is that something that's happening to help broaden the perspectives, or is there way too much pushback from the various groups? You're not going to teach my kids about religion.
It's still there. I mean, the high schools offer classes on religion. You just need an administration with a backbone, and you need a teacher who understands the difference between teaching you about a religion and teaching you to believe a religion. It's not that complicated, though, of course, I understand that doesn't necessarily preclude all kinds of pushback.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, I highly recommend, absolutely. I mean, I'm in favor of every single thing that a child can be exposed to that expands their awareness of differences in the world can only be for good. I do see these courses existing in various high school curriculums. Not enough of an expert to say whether there's a decreasing amount of that or an increasing amount. But I'm certainly with you in favor of that kind of class. I mean, I mentioned sometimes to my kids, for example, the other day, we're reading Flowers for Algernon. Remember that book?
Oh, yes, yes, yes. Uh-huh.
So in a way,
made
it's a garden
a
of... Yes. In a way, it's a Garden of Eden story. Mm-hmm. And so I'm trying to take my kids through that. And I stopped for a minute and said, how many... Can anyone in here tell me the basics of the Garden of Eden story? And I'd say a third of the kids raised their hand. And I said, listen, you should know the basic... Judeo-Christian Bible stories, mm-hmm. not for any other reason except in this context of this conversation, is so that you are actually educated about the incredible number of allusions to it in Western literature, which you will be exposed to from now through the rest of your education. I'm in favor for all kinds of reasons for doing it with the proper way of teaching about other religions.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, I wish that I had learned more about Judaism and Islam and Buddhism and so on and so on and so on. I mean, I was fortunate enough that I came across a group back in the, the early 90s. Never heard of them before. And I became a member of the Baha'i Faith for about a year and a half. Mm-hmm. Great teachings. I absolutely loved them. And I will quote every once in a while a principle, especially the ones about if you accept one of the messengers of God, you accept them all. And if you reject one of the messengers of God, you reject them all, because they all have that thread of truth that runs through what it is that they're espousing, what they're wanting to share. And again, this is just my observation once again, but there was a passage in one of the Gospels, I think it was Matthew's chapter 6, where Jesus is talking about, the animals. We were talking earlier about nature and how the animals, you know, they don't go punch a clock and go work 9 to 5 for their food and their place to live and sleep and lay their head and all that kind of stuff. And yet they're taken care of. So why are you worrying about, you know, where you're going to lay your head tonight and where you're going to get the food to fill your belly this evening and so on and so forth? And I found this passage and I read it to one of my guests and I said, can you tell me where in that passage is capitalism and free enterprise? Because I don't see it. I don't see it in there. Because to me, that's the epitome. And yet a lot of people who promote the concept, I'm not disparaging capitalism and free enterprise. I'm just making an observation here that they will use an Old Testament passage that you will now earn your keep, if you will, by the sweat of your brow. You know, well, in a manner of speaking, that's always been the case. But, you know, it's all about points of reference. And I remember listening to a comedian, Dennis Miller, and listening to some of his comedy back in the 80s and 90s, and he would use what I referred to as obscure historical references. Well, they were only obscure because I didn't know anything about them. So I didn't have any points of reference, so I kind of got the humor in the context, but not fully because I didn't know necessarily who the individuals were he was speaking about 500 or 1,000 or 10,000 years ago. Now, I just finished reading a book called Stranger in a Strange Land, one of the classics, right? And I'm trying to work my way through Ulysses, and I'm using Audible, so it's a little easier. I loved the book, A Stranger. I didn't like the ending, and I'm not going to spoil it for anybody who hasn't read it yet, but I think it's a great book, and it has intertwined in it economics and religion, kind of like the Dune trilogies in sci-fi. Same kind of thing, and those are the kinds of, that's the kind of input that you're talking about that we really need to be taking in. I mean, I'm just now getting around to the classics, slowly, but I'm getting there.
That's good, because like nobody reads in our country anymore.
No, they don't. And even though it is, in a recorded format, I always want to make sure that I get the unabridged version. I don't want the abridged version. I want to hear.
I'm a big fan of Audible.
Yeah, I want to hear the whole thing. Okay.
Yeah. Absolutely.
I don't care if it takes me 62 days.
Yeah.
You know, and I've always loved listening to books. So this is fascinating stuff. And I'm wondering if your book, We're Doing It Wrong, is that available on Audible yet?
No, not yet. Unfortunately, I'm hoping that as it starts to catch on, which it seems to be slowly doing. That'll be the next the next step for it.
Again, the title is We're Doing It Wrong. 25 ideas in education that just don't work and how to fix them. We've been talking about that with our special guest here on the program, David Michael Slate. And this is fascinating stuff. And the website that I'm going to send you folks to that I have here is just that, David Michael Slater. Where did the R go when I just mentioned your name here? David Michael Slater is his name, and we will send you there. We will link to your website, David, so that people can get more information and learn more about you and the work that you're doing.
Thank you. Let me throw in a second site.
Sure.
If your listeners are interested, they can go directly to www.weareDoingItWrong.com with a colleague, a blog, and a podcast. And the blog is publishing. We're actually welcoming and inviting anybody to submit short pieces of their thoughts on anything education related, whether they're an expert or not. And then on the podcast side, we're interviewing really prominent educators. We've had some incredible guests and just basically kind of free-form discussions, which I prefer, just like the one we're having, because they usually lead to unexpected gems. So they can find those there.
That's good stuff. Absolutely good stuff. Well, David Michael Slater, I want to thank you so much for joining us here on the program, sharing with us the book and the work that you're doing in regards to education. And we are looking for some good things coming out of all of this, because, well, we need some good things coming out of all of this. It is perplexing to me how our civilization is going to even continue if we don't have people who are not just educated in, but who are choosing to pursue many of the fine arts and sciences. Before we let you go, let me ask you also about what are your thoughts about the STEM and STEAM programs that are being promoted these days?
Well, it's funny, the STEM came first until people started to say, what about the English part? You know, what about the language? It's all good. To me, I sort of watch the pendulum swinging with some amusement in terms of our foci. You know, that's where we are now, and people will see at some point that we're neglecting something else, and the pendulum will swing back there. Mm. So what I'm optimistic and hopeful that we're going to decide to make this an attractive profession for teachers, and we're going to start attracting people back to the classroom, and who are committed and who feel valued.
Well,
that's my hope.
Yeah, and I would sure love to be able to hear that teachers are going into the classroom not afraid, that they can actually teach instead of having to deal with a lot of the other subjects, like dealing with feeling safe in the classroom and sex education, but specifically from a politically motivated perspective and those kinds of things, and get down to teaching kids how to think once again, and not what to think. And that's been my phrase for years, is that that's what we need to be about, teaching kids how to think and not what to think.
I couldn't agree with you more.
If I could throw one final question at you, you mentioned earlier in the interview about money. And I've often felt that we've been throwing money at education for decades, long before I ever got into school. And it seems like things have just gotten worse and worse. And obviously, that's the reason why you've written the book, We're Doing It Wrong. So is it that we need more money, or is it that the money needs to be spent differently? Or third option is we need to implement your solutions in order for the monies to be used more efficiently and effectively to make the kinds of changes that we need in our educational system.
Well, I'd probably say all of the above.
Okay.
I mean, I know money isn't always spent well, but I mean, compare our education budget to our military budget. It's literally a drop in an ocean. So I'm not sure it's actually fair and right to say we keep throwing money at education. I mean, if you look through the thousands of schools in this country in poor communities that are absolute abominations, then I'm just not sure it makes sense to say that we throw money at schools.
Okay. David Michael Slater, again, I thank you so much for joining us, and also encourage you, should you find yourself here in the Santa Barbara area, we'd love to have you in studio to continue this conversation. And also remind our listeners to go to not only davidmichaelslater.com, but also We're Doing It Wrong, right? We're Doing It Wrong.com.
Mm-hmm. Right.
All right. And we'll get folks to those websites as well. And before we let you go, three final questions, and then the test will be over.
Sure.
First question is, who is David Michael Slater?
I am a teacher and an author. I'm actually going to seize this opportunity to mention that actually this is my first book of nonfiction. I've published 20 plus books for almost a fiction for almost every age level, picture books. I have a series for called early chapter books for 7 to 10 year olds called Mysterious Monsters that's in process right now. A seven book teen series that just finished called Forbidden Books, and a novel for adults called Fun and Games. So that's the other side of me.
Well, that sounds like fun. Second question is, what is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you're doing now?
You know, I'm glad you asked that because obviously I feel like I have specific tangible suggestions in this book, or I wouldn't have written it. But honestly, if nothing else came out of it, except that policymakers and lawmakers might read this book, and if they only thought at the end of it, you know what, maybe we really should be talking to teachers, you know, about education policy. If that alone happened, I would consider it a great success. I'll just mention that the book is really for three audiences. It's for teachers, and so far teachers are finding it really gratifying to find, you know, I won't claim all teachers agree with all my ideas, but they agree with a lot of them. And they're happy to see them finally like put on paper and published. It's also for just the general public. If you have any interest in education, if you feel like you know that our education system needs drastic improvement, but you don't believe the sound bites about evil unions and, you know, brainwashing teachers, it's written in an extremely accessible way. You know, there's no technical teacher speak in there. And again, I'm gratified to hear that just regular citizens are finding the book really fascinating. And then again, policymakers.
And finally, what is your life's purpose?
Well, so you want to end on an easy question, huh?
Sure.
Honestly, I feel like my purpose is to write. People ask me why I'm a writer, and I essentially cannot come up with a good reason other than I feel like it's my life purpose.
Once again, David, thank you for joining us, and we look forward to having you back on the program in the not-too-distant future. I'm Richard Dugan, and I thank you for listening, and I hope that you were educated, such as myself, and I'm trying to learn as well, and I'm glad we had David on the program to educate us a little bit more about the process, and hey, there are solutions. We just need to start doing some of them. I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next time. Love, Talal.